Okay, regarding this presentation, Valerie Kaur, a Sikh activist, gave a powerful speech asking, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What does the midwife say? Breathe and then push. What if this time, when so much of what I see happening in my church, country, and world is shrouded in fear, is not the end? I will look at the moments of darkness that have become rebirth. At a new activist movement where Mormon women are creating a new world and invite all to see how we can go through this labor together. Jody England Hansen spent her time as an unpaid volunteer at church, which taught her to be an unpaid social activist at this crucial time. She is rematriating to Utah since moving back to Salt Lake in 2016. Her favorite moment of the day is seeing the view of Mount Olympus each morning. And on a personal note, her father is Eugene England. He was very kind to me, a senior faculty member to a junior faculty member, and I always remember that, as well as all the teachings he gave us. We now turn it to Jody. Thank you.
Thank you. So I was not able to download this. So I was not able to download this speech so that I could play it, but Valerie Kaur, she's a Sikh activist and a lawyer. She gave this six-minute address during a watch night service, a late night service at the Metropolitan AME Church on December 31st, 2016, so about a year and a half ago in Washington, D.C. She joined a few other leaders, Reverend James Thorbs, from New York City, Imam Talib al-Rashid of Harlem, and Reverend William Barber, a pastor in North Carolina. So I'm going to try. Come on. Okay, I'm going to be reading her words. Okay. So she begins with a Sikh blessing. And then she says, which I am not even going to try to pronounce. On Christmas, and then these are her words. On Christmas Eve, 103 years ago, my grandfather waited in a dark and dank cell. He sailed by steamship across the Pacific Ocean from India to America, leaving behind colonial rule. But when he landed on American shores, immigration officials saw his dark-skinned, his tall turban worn as a part of his Sikh faith, and saw him not as a brother but as a foreign, a suspect, threw him behind bars, where he languished for months until a single man, a white man, a lawyer named Henry Marshall, filed a writ of habeas corpus that released him on Christmas Eve, 1913. My grandfather, Kihar Singh, became a farmer, free to practice the heart of his Sikh faith, love, and oneness. Sound familiar? So when his Japanese-American neighbors were rounded up and taken to their own detention camps, to the deserts of America, he went out to see them when no one else would. He looked after their farms until they returned home. He refused to stand down. In the aftermath of September 11th, when hate violence exploded in these United States, a man that I called Uncle was murdered. I tried to stand up. I became a lawyer like the man who freed my grandfather. I joined a generation of activists fighting detentions and deportation, surveillance and special registration, hate crimes, and racial profiling. And after 15 years, with every film, with every lawsuit, with every campaign, I thought we were making a nation safer for the next generation. And then my son was born. On Christmas Eve, I watched him ceremoniously put the milk and cookies by the fire for Santa Claus, and after he went to sleep, I then drank the milk and ate the cookies. I wanted him to wake up and see them gone in the morning. I wanted them to believe in a world that was magical. But I am leaving my son a world that is more dangerous than the one I was given. We are raising a brown boy in America, a brown boy who may someday wear a turban as part of his faith. And in America today, we enter an era of enormous rage As white nationalists hail this moment as their great awakening, as hate acts against Sikhs and our Muslim brothers and sisters are at an all-time high, I know that there will be moments, whether on the streets or in the schoolyards, where my son will be seen as foreign, as suspect, as terrorist. Just as black bodies are still seen as criminal, brown bodies are still seen as illegal, trans bodies are still seen as immoral, indigenous bodies are still seen as savage, the bodies of women and girls seen as someone else's property. And when we see these bodies not as brothers and sisters, then it becomes easier to bully them, to rape them, to allow policies that neglect them, that incarcerate them, that kill them. Yes, Rabbi, the future is dark. On this Christmas Eve's year, on this New Year's Eve, this watch night, I close my eyes, and I see the darkness of my grandfather's cell. And I can feel the spirit of the ever-rising optimism in the Sikh tradition, Chardi Kala, ever-rising high spirits within him. So the mother in me asks, what if? What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America is not dead, but a country that is waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind now? Those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault, what if they are whispering in our ears, you are brave? What if this is our nation's greatest transition? What does the midwife tell us to do? Breathe and then push. Because if we don't push, we will die. If we don't push, our nation will die. Tonight we will breathe. Tomorrow we will labor in love, through love, and your revolutionary love is the magic we will show our children. So, for those of you who have been able to come to some of the vigils and the marches, this is frequently quoted in the past year and a half. This is a powerful rallying cry to be a part of birthing a new nation and not be a part of despairing in the end of things that have been good and powerful or standing for things that are really amazing in our life. And so often, this same kind of concern, despair for what is happening in our country is also very similar to the despair felt when things happen, when things do not go the way we expect them to go in our church, in our communities, in our world, and in our families. I thought it was interesting that yesterday a friend of mine contacted me during one of the sessions, and I stepped out to call her. This is someone that I've known since I was little. We were actually born within hours of each other and joked that we were sisters from different mothers. But we have had a very close relationship and stay in contact over the years. So when she texted me and said, do you have a few minutes to talk now? Especially with the advocacy work I've been doing, I usually know what that means. And so as I was able to call her and talk with her, and she told me how her son has come out, her son who is married and has two children, and who whose wife did not know, and who she loves more than anything. And has no hesitation about how amazing he is and how much to love him, and yet fears for the world where he and his wife are going to be figuring this out. And she was still in a place of his wife is amazing, he's amazing, and they intend to make this work. And I told her, because I couldn't tell her differently, that the chances for them to have healthy lives and remain married were very slim. And just asked her to prepare for something. And at first she was despairing. But I asked her to consider that this is not the end. It's the beginning of something that she hadn't considered before. It may be the beginning of her son and his wife considering things that were very different from what they had intended or hoped or pictured when they got married. But it could still be even greater, a new life, a reborn life. And I think this is something that would be important for us to see, no matter where we're looking. It is completely appropriate to feel pain and hurt and despair when we feel there is an end coming to what we expected. And so I want this to be a little bit of an interaction. I'm going to be sharing some things, and then I'm going to ask you to consider coming up and sharing your ideas about areas or events and how, instead of being the darkness of the tomb, it is the darkness of the womb. So really, this is about being born again. Birth is a process where we are pushed and squeezed through a space that causes discomfort to the point of trauma, squeezing the fluid out of our lungs so we can have room to take in oxygen, the breath of life in the new world in which we are born. So a lot of times, instead of seeing that being reborn is a really fun, neat, isn't this cool experience, it is an experience that is really confronting, painful, and deep impact on our body. Thinking it needs to be or should be otherwise is only going to make it more difficult. Can we embrace the squeezing out of what will no longer nourish us so that we can breathe in what will now give us life? Frequently in the scriptures, we are told, the only thing that Christ asks us to do is bring a broken heart and a contrite spirit. And a lot of times people think, well, he's requiring us to be hurt. And I've come to realize, from my own view, that when a heart is filled with pain or fear or anger or heaviness, we are holding it in. The imagery is often a hard heart. And we make the mistake of thinking a hard heart is one that just hates. But I think often a hard heart is one that refuses to let go of what has happened, is hanging on to all of those past feelings of hurt and anger and pain. And rightly so. This has become a part of us. We have lived it. We have felt it. And the pain is real. What Christ asks us to do, and the way it impacts me, is Christ felt and was one with me long before I ever had a heart that could be hard. Long before the things that brought pain and hurt so deeply into me. But he felt those things for me long before and continues to the moment they happen and every moment I feel them. There is no guarantee for him that I will turn and receive his love. That's overwhelming to me. And it breaks my heart open, because that love is what breaks it. In breaking my heart open, only then can the hate and the anger and the fear and the hurt be released. And in the space that is left, it is filled with the new air of new life, of love. A contrite spirit cannot remain holding on to what was. A contrite spirit is one that wants to receive new. And this is a way you can be reborn. It's a way that Christ asks us and invites us to time after time after time, without saying, do this without hurting. He's not saying that. He is saying, let me be a part of this. Let me carry with you. And let me fill your heart, let me fill your lungs with a new way of breathing. So some of the things that happens is in seeing that a moment of despair, a moment where you cannot comprehend how you can go on, receiving an inspiration for a new way of seeing it is a way truly and deeply that I think we multiply and replenish. So let's see which one I want to do. So let's consider a few things that have occurred. In the scriptures, it talks about Jonah. Jonah was told to go and bring the good news to Nineveh. Jonah was deeply racist. So here is a typical prophet, and a lot of times people say typical of the Old Testament or New Testament. I say anytime. Deep bias. He displays a great deal of clinging to the way he's always thought and felt, his racism. He does not want to go there. He thinks these are awful people. He thinks these are people not worth sharing the good news. And he tries to run away. He needed to be consumed. Completely surrounded by a big fish, which, by the way, is one of the symbols of Christ. Completely consumed in a point to the point that he could not be impacted anymore by his surroundings, except the surrounding of being with himself. He then, you could consider that he was vomited out, or you could consider that it was the darkness of the womb. And he was pushed out, still racist, but he went and he taught the people of Nineveh. After he did what he was told to do, he went and wanted to stand up there and watch the city destroyed, still racist. For him, whatever he offered to that city, it was too little, too late. But they, the people of Nineveh, are an example of a people who released, let what was there be squeezed out, and took in new life. They did not allow the failures of the person who brought the good news to keep them from being reborn. It's messy. It is messy, the examples we are given about how this can work. We keep trying to clean them up. We keep trying to make rebirthing a nice, pleasant, pain-free, clean experience. About a year and a half ago, I was able to hear Marlon Jensen speak on a panel of LDS historians. And they were talking about the new way that the church is teaching, writing about, participating in its history. And he said that what he saw as the turning point for transparency for church history is when this more recent book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre was published with the cooperation of the church. They were a part of telling a very candid, all no holds barred account of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. He said, here it is, the darkest event in our history, and they were sharing it candidly in this publication. I didn't have a chance to talk to him that evening, but a few days later he spoke at this performance of The Messiah that my stake was doing, and I was in the choir, so I was just a few feet away from him and went right up to him after the meeting and thanked him for his friendship to my parents and chatted, and then I referred to this panel, And I said, Elder Jensen, I thought it was really interesting what you said about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and I'm going to ask you to consider something. That is no longer the darkest day in our history. The darkest day in our history is now November 5th, 2015. The death toll is greater. The impact is higher. The dissonance is much bigger. We do not have the luxury of sweeping it under the rug for over 100 years before we are forced to pull it out and confront it. It is everywhere. And the details of it and the dissonance of it were clear from the first moment that this was leaked. What do you think will happen with how the church handles this point in history? And he said, I think you're right. I think this is the darkest day in our history, November 5th, 2015. And he says, and I hope we will learn much more quickly about it. So, for a second, before I move on to the next thing. Well, actually, let me mention this, and then I'm going to invite you to come up and give your feedback about how this might occur. So, Election Day 2016 did not birth the new day that I thought it would. For me or for a lot of other people, and there was a lot of work to do between that and the inauguration, mostly with suicide prevention and despair. But on Inauguration Day, I was flying back east to be a part of the Women's March, and immediately after there was a Mormon feminist retreat there in D.C. that was really incredible. And what I appreciated is all of those of us who were at the retreat were in different journeys in our life. Just like in the march, I was surrounded by people. Every sign had a different message. Every person there had something that was speaking to them as to the reason they were there. But the sense of unity was incredible. And the same with the march. We were sharing very different views, very different outlooks, different ages, different experiences. But that did not matter. We were coming together seeking where we could be unified and find strength with each other. And on that day and that week, there were several women who were watching what was happening and the immediate actions taken to turn our country into one with closed doors and closed arms, to do things that overturned laws that were hard fought for. And several of these women decided to start, just six of them decided to start an organization called Mormon Women for Ethical Government. And they just started as a Facebook group with a few other friends joining, saying, together we can find ways to hold our representatives accountable for an ethical government. In a matter of 4 weeks, there were 4,000 women in this group, and the original six were scrambling to figure out how to do this. What I appreciate, and I was invited by one of them pretty early on, and there were many different things, discussions, and what do we do, and what do we stand for, and being Mormon women, how much of this is about being Mormon women, and how much of it is about standing for ethical government, and I really appreciated how they were constantly seeking wisdom. They did not say, here we are, not moving, and you can't tell us anything different. They were going, here we are, and we have a lot to learn. Let's share this. And for many of them, this was their first foray into activism. And they were willing to wrestle with it because they could not allow victory. And I'm speaking figuratively and in a sense literally. They could not allow victory for the serpent that threatens their life, their wisdom, and their children. So So when you take a lot of women who have spent, as was mentioned, who have spent their life running organizations with no budget, no authority, no permission, no voice, but they get all of the work done, do not underestimate what they can do as an activist organization. And even though this was their first, for many of them, it is their first experience into activism, they constantly impress me. And the first time there was any kind of a meeting, I went to it kind of going, okay, I'm just, you know, because I've been an activist for over 50 years, since I was 8. And my dad was taking me around the Bay Area to pass out flyers and go to rallies. This is tough stuff. When you're an activist, you cannot be fragile in your opinions. You can't treat anything as being fragile and not worthy of examination. It's one of the reasons I see the church as very strong and powerful, and it can take the observations, it can take the criticisms, or it's not worth being there. And so activism has taught me that, and the church has taught me to be an activist. So when women are confronting these things for the first time, and there are these conversations and these long threads that go on for hundreds of comments, and they kept tagging me in going, okay, I'm new to LGBTQ activism, you've got to step in here and have this conversation with them. And when some of them kept, you know, usually one or two, not a lot of them, because these women are ready to get things done. But when one or two keep coming back and say, no, we need to agree on what the doctrine is, and they tag me in and I go, actually, no, we don't. No one does. The Quorum of the 12 Apostles, there's not agreement on this. There's not agreement on this in any group you're going to be with. You'll have two people together and they won't agree. Even if they say they do, they don't. And there's no way to know because you cannot get inside someone else's head. Agreement never makes a difference. We are not here to agree. It will never matter if we agree on this. We are here because we're committed to this country being a place where we can raise our children in an ethical, safe way. That is what we're here for. We're not here to agree on doctrine. And I have resisted saying, sorry, this is not church. I don't care if you leave. But there is a place to respect what we're there for. What has been really interesting is the way these women who are involved in this are constantly confronting the way they've always been. They are constantly confronting what the world has been up to this point, and they are constantly allowing things to be squeezed out of their lungs and pulling in new air and seeing a new way of living. And the thing that I find especially interesting is they will never do church the same again. And one of the things I looked for, especially this being a women's organization, it really is a women's organization. And not a single one of them has ever said, I need to check with my husband before I do this. I'm going to run this by my bishop before I frame this. Not once, not a single time. This might not be the darkness of the tomb. This is the darkness of the womb. So before I move on to the next thing, does anyone want to come up and take a minute to observe what they are seeing, at least in these events, that might be showing up as the darkness of the womb? Yeah.
Okay, I adore your metaphor, first of all, and it's also traumatizing me.
I'm keeping my eye on you, Valade. I'm serious. I keep looking over like... And if you need to come up here and stand next to me while you're talking, that's fine.
Okay.
This side.
So until you go into labor for the first time, you don't know how horrifying that's going to be. Or how worth it it's going to be. There's that hope that this will all come out right. and you'll have this beautiful child to hold. Provided there's not a cord wrapped around its neck, or it's rendered speechless, you know. And the first thing you look for is that heartbeat. I suspect I'm with a lot of people who are waiting for the heartbeat and to hear that baby cry. And know that indeed its lungs did fill with new air. And it's breathing in its own life on its own. But when I was in labor with my first child, my husband was right there with me, and I was bearing down in a contraction, and forgive the graphics, but she started it. And he's a big guy. He's a big guy. He's a strong guy. And I had a hold of both of his hands. And when the pain got really, really intense, I had my kids natural. And I was holding his hands through the contraction, which felt eternal. And he started to cry because he thought I was going to break his hands. I was twisting them and holding on for dear life. And
at which point I want to play a sad song on my tiny violin for him worried about you breaking his hands.
Yeah, but you know, it was painful for him too, and it was painful for him to watch me and not be able to relieve my pain. And that is a template overlay. I think he thinks I'm going to break him too. And I can't help him right now because I'm still waiting to get my own breath. And while this tiny violin plays, there's a lot of pain on the other side and a lot of feeling of helplessness, and he helped get me here. And he can't figure out how to get me through it or out of it. And it's really painful.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I didn't minimize
it. No. There's only so much empathy we can have for a man while a woman's going through childbirth. I'm sorry, men. I love men, but it's just a reality. And in this situation, he's also a support and trying to be a support. You know, it's just painful. It's painful for everyone, but there's that moment that you realize the head is too engaged or partway out, and there's no going back. Surely that child can't survive there any longer anyway, you know. But I see the glimpses of the beauty that's to come, and I would never trade it for anything. And the beauty that it is, truly. But it's a death. I remember in childbirth thinking, this is what death is. This is death. I don't know if I'll live through this or the baby will live through this. And it was very close to that, and it's to death. And it's waiting for a rebirth, and it's painful. And hopefully very life-giving, and I appreciate
it. Thank you. That's really generous. Yeah, go ahead. Transition is never ending.
I guess I won't speak so much about the actual, you know, birth metaphor, even though I love it too. I think I'm a very optimistic person in general. And what I've been just thinking is, I admire people like you. I've been much of an activist myself before I moved to a new country, and it's been hard to engage here because I don't get the system, I don't get the culture, I don't have the language. It's been a ride. But anyway, I'm just thinking it, you know, whether we go marching, whether we engage, politically or in church or, you know, for specific causes, whatever it might be, some of us are more prone to do that. Some don't. They don't want to stand like you and talk. They don't They don't know how to express themselves. They don't even know how they feel. And that can be also very difficult because you want to be part of, you know, doing something. But I don't think we need to be so hard on it ourselves. I think, you know, you may have seen that picture, you know, one of those silly things that you see on the internet. There is a picture of, you know, with thousands of people raising their hands in a Heil Hitler, you know, greeting. And there's one guy in the middle standing like this. And it speaks volumes to me. And I just feel like, just be that guy, right? And I think that all we need to do, what everybody can do, first of all, kind of check ourselves and free our hearts from hate, whatever it might be. It's a natural inclination to be prejudiced, racist, you know, homophobic, all of that. That's the natural man, I think. But we have to work against that. And that's something everybody can do. We can be part of the solution, not part of the problem, by checking our own hearts. And sometimes that's the only activism you need to do. It's just making sure that you're that guy. I don't know if I make sense.
Yeah, a lot of sense. And by the way, I don't get the system either. And I'm really involved in it, so thank you. Yeah, I don't want this to be about you should, or this is how it has to look for you. These are just, so I'm glad you said that. I agree. And, well, for instance, another thing that I was going to talk about is that, you know, that not only the November 5th, 2015, but also January 2016, when, for whatever reason, Elder Nelson, President Nelson gave a talk elevating the policy to revelation status. We do know that that really caught a lot of the leaders off guard because that's not what happened. What he said was pretty much the script that was given in 1978 when that was announced, with the whole quorum announcing it together. There's a process to announce when there is an actual revelation, and that's not what happened. So for whatever reason, and to me this is one way that people can choose to be reborn. They can go from squeezing out the fluid in their lungs that thinks every word that comes from our leaders was directly given by God, and breathing in the air of seeing our leaders are fallible. They do things for a lot of different reasons. We don't know why. It may have been that they ate something for breakfast that hurt their stomach. They may be panicking about over worry about a grandchild. Who knows? But for the same reasons that we do a lot of things that have nothing to do with inspiration, they might as well. And it has an impact. And sometimes we, as the individual in the crowd, need to choose how we are going to behave. What we are going to do with that. Will we then seek inspiration? I loved Greg Prince's talk last night about owning your own religion and what it takes. He gave some very concrete actions. As individuals, we can take things that will shift the world into a new world because of how we own our own religion. This is a religion of universal salvation. This is a religion of a God that weeps for us. People can call it a religion about a narrow definition of marriage or anti-gay all they want. If that's what they want to do with it, fine. That is not the religion I own. So as an individual in that crowd, what am I doing? And I think Greg Prince gave some really excellent ways that we can do that. So often, and this was something that... it was talked about by Thomas McConkie earlier in the week. he talks about how the moment we have a thought, we can let it keep living and be a moment towards the next, more expansive thought. We can, or we can ascribe power to it. We can set it up on a pedestal. We can gild it with gold. We can make it be about truth. We can make it about knowing. And then it becomes an idol that we worship that has power over us. We can, even when other people choose to do that, about a thought they have or a legal brief, lending truth to that instead of letting the truth be something that's a process of growth. What if we continue to see that the thought is just another contraction? It's another moment to breathe. It's another opportunity to push. So how is it that something like what happened in November 2015 and January 2016 can be a moment of a new contraction that brings new life? And I think any moment like that is an opportunity. Are we going to continue to breathe the old air of thinking the way we used to think, or is it going to be an opportunity to have more life around a conversation that could either bring despair or open up opportunities to expand? I understand that there's someone who was just called to be stake president back east. And in the interview where he was called, he said, "I can't accept this calling if in any way, shape, or form I need to support this policy." And they said, no problem. And they went ahead and called him and sustained him. It's one thing. You just say one thing. You may not know what happens. You know, if you make it about a hierarchy, it might not work. If you make it about what God inspires you to do and the new life that God asks you to breathe in, it might make a difference. So there are some things that kind of came up. So last November, Mike and I were in Mexico, San Miguel, for Day of the Dead. And it was really an incredible week. It was just amazing and really powerful to see this cultural tradition of having an image, speaking a name, and that brings them back to life. Especially on this day, they are among us. And I just think, we have so much in common from culture to culture and how we connect and honor and you know, see the importance of this. And as I hadn't brought photographs of my dad, so, or Mike's dad, who had recently passed away, and so I made little sketches, and we put them on the table with the flowers, and remembered them, and went to the cemetery and saw the families there and the bands and the children playing. It was before Coco came out, but it was basically like they were there filming us, and that was Coco. And it was so wonderful. Well, what Mike liked to do is get up really early and take pictures in this beautiful little town as the sun would rise and the light on the tile roofs and the flowers. And it was really stunning. We felt completely safe in this town. They were just wonderful. And the last day, we were planning on going out together and taking pictures before we left for the airport. And Mike didn't wake me up. He went out and did this. And then I woke up as he came in the door and called my name and said I was attacked. And I look up, and he's covered with blood. And there are these spreading spots of blood on his shirt where there are slashes. And he said, I was attacked and they stabbed me and I managed to kick them and get away and get back. And I'm getting up and as I'm checking him out, looking at his face and looking at his eyes and then seeing this blood spread, And my hands are on him, removing his clothes to see what's going on, and I'm blessing him. Just begging the molecules to heal. And I'm, you know, I'm taking his jacket and his shirt off and his underwear off, and each one, these spots of blood and the cuts in his clothing. And when it got down to the skin of his chest, of those three places where I had seen where the knife had gone through and the blood had spread out on his clothes, there was one small wound that had stopped bleeding. It was exhilarating and it was terrifying. Because I had had my hands on my dad in those last weeks of his life, time after time, begging for healing. And each time there's that moment of wondering, can I live in a world where God can exist next to me? And there is still the tomb and the womb. And know that God is there with me, whether the wounds disappear or whether the person you love so much is taking their last breath. Because I think Christ, in all his invitation to be nourished and to be reborn in each moment that our heart breaks open and receives love, is also asking us to follow him in all ways. And it leads us to the cross. To the deep wounds on the cross. To the darkness where there really is a tomb for a time. And then the literal new life that comes after. So it is exhilarating and it is terrifying. And I loved how Valait was telling us about that wonderful and horrible experience of birth and holding hands. And it made me think of when I had been diagnosed with cancer, and this has been 7 years ago, and for those of you, and I know it's very likely quite a few in this room have gone through this, being diagnosis of cancer and all the things that follow. And one of the first things that they scheduled after, you know, the biopsy had come back, and I'd met with the surgeon and met with the radiation oncologist, and they had kind of laid out what they were looking at. And so they scheduled an MRI to see if they could detect how far it might be. And it never hurts to ask. So we were there, and they were preparing me, and Mike was with me, and I said, can he be in the room with me? And they kind of, actually, I guess he could. And so when it's breast cancer, you're lying on your stomach, and with cutouts and everything. So you're lying on your stomach, and my arms were over my head. And they kind of roll the tray into the MRI machine, but my hands remain outside the machine. So Mike was standing there, and they had told me, you're going to be in there about 45 minutes. They're going to do a series, and the noise is going to be like this. And they have ear sound blocking earphones on, and so also they can communicate with me and say, okay, we're done with this stage and now it's going to sound like this, and so I couldn't hear Mike and he couldn't talk to me, but they were in the booth, they were talking to me. So it's very isolating, and when there are all these thoughts going through your head, you don't know, you know that you've been diagnosed, you know that it's a certain type, and you know that this is going to reveal some information that at most is no worse than what you've heard, or it could be a lot more devastating. And that 45 minutes can seem like an eternal labor. And so I was in this tube, and I was reaching out, and Mike was holding my hand. And through the whole thing, every minute, he would squeeze to signal me, it's another minute by. You made it through another minute. And what it was this moment of being reborn together. Whatever we were going to find out, whatever was going to come out of that tube, we were connected. And we would do this. And the hope was there would be more air to breathe and a new life to have together. And I think this is why time and again we turn to community. And we don't, I think it's an important thing to remember. We don't need to agree. We don't need to share the same experiences. But we can hold each other's hands. We can be unified in what we're committed to do here together. And so things like when there's something that is not what we expected, it doesn't mean that we cannot be holding each other's hands and reminding each other we're here together in this. And we may not know what it's going to look like, but we can keep breathing together. Anything that you want to observe about some of those moments of... Anyone here at Greg Prince's talk last night? I saw all kinds of rebirth moments with that. So, I think some of you know this already. Another rebirth that's taking place is without knowing too many specific details, I know that talk from January 2016 kind of gave rise to some behind-closed-door discussion that pretty much got enough of them saying, we cannot keep talking about this until we understand more. So at the very least, stop talking about this. And if you'll notice, in the new website, Mormon and Gay, which has gone through several updates, and the new pages on LDS.org that are about suicide prevention, specifically mentioning the importance of LGBTQ awareness and inclusion, there is absolutely no mention of this horrible, destructive policy. And it's never been mentioned in conference. Not only that, but the restrictive parts of the proclamation have not been mentioned. Marriage has not been mentioned. And we, you know, there are a lot of conversations going on that we hope are inviting greater light and knowledge. I'm surprised at how many people I've met, openly gay, out, people who have felt inspired to join the church since the policy. And they've been meeting with church leaders. And I'm not in any way, shape, or form, because I'm deeply confronted by it, excusing the harm or the damage. And I want to be one of the people who is not saluting, but one of the people who is encouraging some new air to fill our lungs. Because I do think there is something amazing about the foundations of our religion and the core doctrine. And people can say that the core doctrine is all kinds of things, but to me the core doctrine is universal salvation. We cannot be saved unless all of us are saved. We cannot get anywhere unless all of us are there. And all the human nature conversations of saying, this is me here and you're over there and I need more so you have less, are confronting, and we do need to confront them. But they don't make anything different from a God that will save all of us together if we choose to, or none of us are. It's the only way it can happen. We have less than 1 minute left. Thank you for being here.